Gaza, which killed 9 children. He said since October 2023, more than 300 UN buildings have been damaged or destroyed by Israel, and even 700 people have been killed while seeking UN protection. Lazzarini's remarks came as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has slammed Israel's March 23rd attack on a number of ambulances, killing 15 medics and humanitarian workers. Addressing the UN Security Council, Volker Türk said the appalling attack raises concerns over the commission of war crimes by Israel. He also condemned Israel's ban on the entry of humanitarian aid to Gaza for a month. Türk said the blockade of Gaza constitutes a form of collective punishment and may also amount to the use of starvation as a method of war. In one of the Israeli strikes on a house in Khan Yunis, 9 people from the same family lost their lives, among others, and most of the victims were children. Let's take a listen to the grieving relatives of the family talking about this tragedy.
Around 3 o'clock in the morning, they blew up this house. It's like an earthquake. As you can see, the destruction. Destruction in every sense of the word. There are many martyrs, a man, his wife, his daughter, his sons. And his wife was also pregnant, and they were happy that God had given them another child.
Without warning, the entire family was martyred. A barrage of bombs, more than one missile fell on the house. It was wiped out. There was no house, no rubble, no trees, nothing left of the remains of the house.
I swear to God, they are relieved. Relieved from displacement, from carrying their belongings around, and from worries. What do they want from life? There is nothing left in life. By God, the one who dies finds rest. Believe in God. The one who dies finds rest.
The Israeli regime presses on with its genocide on the Gaza Strip as the regime's forces displace more Palestinians from Rafah and southern Khan Yunis. Our Gaza correspondent Ahmed Al-Najjar visited Khan Yunis, where Israeli forces carried out an airstrike last night on an area the regime itself had designated as a safe zone, killing more civilians.
Here in Al-Katiba area in northwestern Khan Yunis, which is included within the so-called safe zone and not far from the infamous Al-Mawasi area, last night the families inside this neighborhood were sleeping and suddenly a massive explosion happened that shook the entire neighborhood. This home, which belongs to Al-Aggad family, was targeted last night, killing the entire family inside this house. Father, the mother, and the 3 little children. But not only that, because of the devastating and massive scale of the bombardment, 2 of the neighbors as well were killed within this airstrike that was carried by the Israeli occupation.
You can see how closely the homes are built here. We were jolted awake by a thunderous blast, only to find the remains of neighbors scattered across the streets. Our neighborhood has already borne the brunt of Israel's aggression, and now, despite being labeled as a safe zone and instructed to be sought refuge here, we are still enduring relentless bombardment.
Until this morning, the families could collect the remains of the family and the neighbors due to this brutal attack that literally turned the family inside this home into pieces. The neighbors are still cleaning the rubble, looking for any of the remains of the family that was killed here.
The attack was so intense that we thought our home had been bombed, but it was our neighbors. We are still clearing the rubble, searching for more remains of the children who were killed alongside their parents here. These innocent people did nothing to deserve such a brutal end. We call on everyone in the world to put an end to this genocide.
This is the situation inside the so-called safe zone, where the occupation is now directing the families in southern Khan Yunis and Rafah to come to. More massacres and more killing is awaiting the families here who are still subjected to this massive campaign by the occupation that doesn't seem to go any easier on the families here. Ahmed Al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Weeks after the Israeli regime unilaterally broke the ceasefire agreement, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is getting worse. Israeli attacks have forced civilians to leave their homes Aid is blocked and suffering is increasing. Jonathan Whittle, head of UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office for the Occupied Palestinian Territory, has painted a grim picture of the humanitarian situation in the besieged strip and called on UN member states to take political and economic action to enforce international law.
What is happening here defies decency, it defies humanity, it defies the law. It really is a war without limits. People have been bombed in food distribution points where aid workers have also been killed. Humanitarian warehouses have been damaged in strikes. And since the ceasefire collapsed 2 weeks ago, forced displacement orders are back. So in the last 2 days alone, we've had around 100,000 people that have been displaced out of Rafah, many of them fleeing under fire. As humanitarians, I need to emphasize that we cannot accept that Palestinian civilians are dehumanized to the point of being somehow unworthy of survival. And yet today, unfortunately, marks 1 month without any supplies entering into Gaza. Humanitarians here in Gaza are certainly inspiring, creative, but we're not magicians. We can do our jobs when we're enabled to do so. This crisis needs a political action, and I believe that this needs to start with accountability. Aid will not and cannot compensate for the political failures that we've seen in Gaza. What is happening in Gaza is not going to stay in Gaza. We cannot let the rules-based order be replaced by one set of rules for some and another set of rules for others. But in closing, I do want to acknowledge that there is hope that remains. I've heard people in Gaza say that hope dies last in Gaza. So there is hope that member states will finally use their political and economic leverage to enforce international law. There's hope that a ceasefire comes into effect that stops the slaughter and frees the hostages. And I think there's hope that Palestinians will finally be seen as humans and that this cruelty will end.
Hundreds of protesters have clashed with Israeli forces during fresh demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu outside the headquarters of his Likud party in Tel Aviv. The protest was attended by various groups, including the relatives of Israeli captives held by Hamas. They demanded the regime to stop violating the Gaza ceasefire and bring back the hostages. Some protesters marched from the Hungarian embassy in Tel Aviv, denouncing Netanyahu's visit to the European country that began on Thursday. The Israeli Prime Minister's European trip was made in complete defiance of an arrest warrant issued for him by the International Criminal Court. The scuffles come amid a rise in demonstrations across the occupied territories and increasing discontent with Netanyahu's cabinet after the onslaught on Gaza resumed. Another source of protests is Netanyahu's attempt to remove Shin Bet head Ronen Bar, who has presided over the investigation into a corruption case involving three of Netanyahu's aides. Israeli forces have fatally shot another Palestinian youth near the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem over alleged stone throwing at settler vehicles. Palestinian media quoted the Israeli organization Rescue Without Borders as saying that the regime's forces fired at the Palestinian, inflicting critical injuries to his upper body. The youth was later pronounced dead. The Palestinian Red Crescent said its medical teams were denied access to the scene by Israeli forces, who told them to leave the area. Israel has been frequently condemned for using excessive force against Palestinians in the West Bank and carrying out execution-style killings. The regime's forces often deny medical assistance to people injured in the attacks. Violent raids by Israeli forces and settlers have significantly increased across the occupied West Bank since the Gaza genocide began, leaving at least 940 Palestinians dead so far. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian says the Islamic Republic has never sought war with any country but will not hesitate to defend itself at the highest level of readiness and capability. Pezeshkian made the remarks in a phone call with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman while addressing U.S. threats against Iran's nuclear sites. He reaffirmed that non-peaceful use of nuclear energy has no place in Iran's defense doctrine. Pezeshkian expressed Iran's readiness for dialogue to ease some existing tensions based on mutual interests and respect. He also touched on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Pezeshkian said, if Muslim nations become united, they can end the Zionist regime's crimes against the people of Gaza. The Saudi crown prince, for his part, said cooperation among regional countries is key to the region's peace and stability. Pezeshkian also spoke with chairman of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashad. He said if Muslim countries were united, Arabian powers could not take any act of aggression against them. The Israeli regime has launched another airstrike on southern Lebanon in violation of the ceasefire agreement with the country. This time, an apartment building has been hit in the southern city of Sidon, leaving at least three people dead and several others injured. Some reports indicate that an official of the Hamas resistance movement has been targeted in the attack. No more details are available so far. The new attack followed earlier Israeli air raids, which targeted the Alma al-Shaab and Nagura areas of southern Lebanon. The strikes came several days after Israel bombed Beirut, killing four people, including a woman. It was the second such strike on Beirut in the past week. Israel had not targeted the Lebanese capital since the ceasefire took effect in November. The regime has defied all calls to adhere to its obligations under the agreement, including the withdrawal of its forces from southern Lebanon. Yemeni armed forces have shot down another U.S. drone over the country's airspace that comes as the U.S. has continued its aggression against Yemen over its military operations aimed at pressuring Israel to end its war on Gaza. Youssef Mari reports.
Whatever goes up must come down. A fitting theme for Yemen's military operations in support of Palestine. The armed forces of Yemen have downed yet another U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone, an unmanned combat aerial vehicle capable of remotely control.
The Yemeni army's air defenses, with the help of Allah Almighty, were able to shoot down an American MQ-9 drone while it was carrying out hostile missions in the airspace of Al Hudaydah Governorate. The drone was downed with a locally made surface-to-air missile. This is the second drone being shot down in 72 hours and the 17th one during the operations in support of Gaza.
Yemen began its pro-Gaza operations in November 2023. Experts say the growing number of American drones being shot down by Yemen not only reflects tactical success, but signals a significant leap in the country's military capability.
The U.S. is very upset with what they have suffered in the Red Sea and Arabian Sea as Yemen continues to attack them. Moreover, Yemen will continue to advance militarily. Yemen is not satisfied with only shooting down 17 U.S. drones. In the near future, there will be more surprises that will benefit the people and armed forces of Yemen.
Amid the successful Yemeni operations, U.S. President Donald Trump has claimed that the country conducts its attacks with Iran's support, an allegation strongly denied by the Yemenis.
We will continue to support the people of Palestine. Our military success came from the preparation of our armed and air defense forces, and we will continue to counter this American aggression on our nation. We will continue to support Palestine. Iran is an ally of Yemen. However, they have no say whatsoever with regards to our wars and our military, defending our land from this U.S. aggression.
The United States launched intense airstrikes on Yemen last month after the Arab country resumed its maritime military operations in support of Palestinians in war-ravaged Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces have shot down more U.S. drones, demonstrating their growing capability to counter advanced aerial threats and sending a clear message of defiance amid ongoing aggression against their country. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Israeli warplanes have carried out more airstrikes on Syria, despite mounting condemnations from regional countries as well as the United Nations. On Thursday, Israeli aircraft carried out at least two strikes on military targets near the capital, Damascus. They reportedly hit military sites in the vicinity of Al-Kisfa and Al-Mughayliba outside Damascus. There were no immediate reports of casualties. The attacks came less than a day after similar Israeli strikes and a ground incursion killed 13 people in Syria. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said Israel struck five separate areas within a 30-minute window, resulting in the near-complete destruction of Hama airbase. The regime's strikes have drawn strong condemnations from Iran, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. UN envoy for Syria Geir Pedersen also decried the repeated and intensifying military escalations by Israel, accusing the regime of destabilizing Syria. Take care and bye-bye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Humanitarian aid has not entered Gaza for nearly a month due to the Zionist regime's blockade. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Hoda Hellas enjoyed a brief respite during the first days of the latest two-month ceasefire. She lived with her family of eight in a makeshift tent in Al-Wehda Street, central Gaza City, after their house in Ash-Shajaya was bombed by an Israeli regime airstrike in 2023. She and her family had a plan for various dishes they wanted to cook during Ramadan. That plan was turned upside down on March 2nd, when the Zionist regime closed the borders, halting the entry of all humanitarian aid, food, and goods into Gaza. The renewed blockade has brought the enclave to the brink of famine once again. Hoda said, "We used to cook a variety of dishes every day, but now, for over 20 days, all we've had is rice. Now it's starting to give me severe stomach cramps." Recently, the United Nations Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, said in its latest update that the Zionist regime's ban on entry of aid has continued for nearly a month and that no aid entered the enclave throughout this period. All requests by humanitarian agencies to coordinate access with Israeli authorities have been denied. Moreover, Israeli regime attacks killed eight humanitarian workers since its unilateral decision to resume hostilities on Gaza on March 18th, bringing the total number of aid workers killed by Israeli regime army in Gaza to 399. Ellis recalled, when the blockade was imposed, the shops were empty within hours, and what was left was too expensive. Even the charity distributions, which once offered a variety of meals, have dwindled, now providing only small servings of rice at the time of iftar. After days of eating little more than rice, Hoda couldn't sleep at night, suffering from severe stomach pain and colic. She was diagnosed with a stomach infection 2 weeks ago. She said, "Doctors advised me to eat healthy food and avoid canned goods, but there is nothing else to eat except the low-quality charity distribution. I'm surviving on eating only bread and cheese, when possible." Hella's mother, Manal, 52, was also supposed to eat healthy food. She suffered a heart attack and high blood pressure at the beginning of this month. Huda thinks that the main reason for her mother's deteriorating health is living in the harsh conditions in the tents, including the dire lack of food and clean water for drinking. Huda recalled, "During Ramadan, my mother used to prepare a beautiful spread of chicken, meat and vegetables, carefully preparing each dish for the family. Now, she looks at us helplessly, asking us to hang on, hoping that the starvation will not last much longer." Before the ceasefire, Huda and her family had been displaced to Khan Yunis in the southern part of Gaza. She said, "We were not able to find a piece of bread. For 2 months, we lived only on canned hummus." During the ceasefire, Huda and her family feared the return of war and the famine that would inevitably follow. And that is what was happening. She said, "It's unfair to live in starvation again." Ahmad Ramda, 38, also struggles to find something to eat or feed his 4 children during the Zionist regime's current complete blockade on the entry of humanitarian aid, including food. He thinks that the blockade's impact is even worse than last year. He said, "We no longer have the energy to flee from one place to another, fetch water, or even recover from wounds due to the lack of food and medical care. They want us to be homeless, reliant on limited humanitarian aid. But all we want is for the borders to open so we can work, make a living, and live in peace." He was once a driver, but his car was bombed by Israeli regime airstrikes in November 2023 while he and his family were evacuating. His house was also destroyed, his father killed, and many other family members were wounded. Now Ramda and his family live in a tent on Omar Mukhtar Street in the central Gaza Strip. Ahmad said, "My children cry every day, refusing to eat the lentils or rice from the charity distributions. They ask me for chicken, meat and fruits. Their mother even lied to them, telling them she put minced meat in the food, but it melted while cooking. I wish to be dead before the moment I see my children starve to death." In January 2024, Ramda and his wife, Sana, welcomed their baby girl, Misk, into the world in their displacement tent in Deir al-Balah, in the middle of the Gaza Strip. However, due to the lack of proper nutrition, Sana had a difficult time breastfeeding Misk. Tragically, Misk died of malnutrition in August 2024. Ramda explained through tears, "Sana struggled to breastfeed Misk due to the lack of healthy food and because we couldn't afford what was available in the markets." Meanwhile, his 10-year-old daughter, Jory, has been battling dehydration. He said, "I lost one daughter, and I'm terrified of losing another before the borders open and we get food. I appeal to the world to end our suffering. Not for us, the adults, but for the sake of our children who are deprived of their most basic rights." Mazen Ma'ruf, 48, a farmer, struggles to survive with his 11-member family. During the ceasefire, he and his 6 sons had planted tomatoes and onions on their farmland in Beit Lahia, hoping to feed themselves and make a living from their crops. But when the Zionist regime broke the ceasefire on March 18th, their plans were shattered. Ma'ruf said, "Israeli regime artillery and aerial shelling began suddenly in the morning. We could only take our tent we didn't know where to go. Maruf and his family could hardly find an empty place to set up their tent in Yarmouk neighborhood due to the crowded movement of displaced people. They are still struggling to find something to eat, as they have no money and were unable to bring any food with them when they evacuated. The north of the Gaza Strip, especially Beit Hanun, was once considered the food basket of Gaza, but has been decimated by the war. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, at least 67.6% of cropland in northern Gaza has been destroyed by the Zionist regime. Maruf explained, "We only eat when charity distributions come or when others share their canned food. My family and I are sick and suffering from malnutrition. We don't want to rely on humanitarian aid. We want the war to stop now and to live in peace and dignity."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be average. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on IRB English Radio. And obviously the title is Be Average. And, you know, in a sense, depending on where you've grown up, you might think, oh, this does not sound nice. Be average, you know, and obviously more in the, let's say, in the West or more amongst non-Muslims, obviously they there is the idea to sort of not really be aspiring to be average, but we're supposed to be unique and special and the best at whatever it is and the leaders and all these things. And, you know, those are not necessarily Islamic values, though some of that creeps into the way we think and even into our lifestyles for sure. So there's a very special, famous martyr, Eminence the Sayyid, who, for example, was always concerned with the welfare of people. And this idea of being average, in a sense, is something that he referred to himself. So he would say, for example, that if he were not able to be like the unfortunate, so like the really poor people, the very deprived people, what he could do, at least, is to be like the average. So in his life, in his clothes, in his food. And obviously this also reminds us and harks back to, you know, obviously the lifestyles of, for sure, other martyrs and the lifestyles of our prophets, the lifestyles of our imams. And I always, when I hear this particular thing of, you know, being average, being very humble, I immediately, maybe you have similar thoughts, other thoughts, I always think immediately of Imam Ali and what a humble life he led, though of course he could have in theory had access to the greatest wealth. He was the greatest warrior. He was the, let's say, the initiator, the founder of Arabic grammar. He was a philosopher, he was a metaphysician and everything, and yet he led a life, we could probably even say even below average in terms of his lifestyle. But obviously this is something that matters to our martyrs. Welcome back, this is A to Z and IRB English Radio. And so I'm talking about being average, and being average is, you know, something we actually can aspire to, even though you might think it's a little bit of a paradox. How can we aspire? To aspire is to sort of look up, to reach higher to some lofty goal. And then you would think, well, being average, isn't that below that? But, you know, actually being average as a Muslim means that we've really reached this understanding where we are humble and we don't want to appear better, superior to anyone else. Be it in, let's say, our wealth, sort of appearance, or let's say in a display or demonstration of our knowledge. And obviously some of these people who are extremely humble, and I've mentioned Imam Ali and everything he did, and obviously in his display of knowledge probably too, and I've just mentioned His Eminence the Sayyid. Even if a person is extremely knowledgeable, and we could, for example, also take the example of Imam Khomeini, they are the most concerned to sort of not be boastful, to not appear as if they know more than us, more than the other person, more than another expert, more than another scholar. Of course, in the life of the Sayyid, he could have bought the best cars, the best houses, but obviously he didn't. He wanted to be the average. And he also taught this to his family. So he expected the same thing from the children. And that obviously is something we can think about in our lives. Because to some extent, obviously, when our children are going about their lives at work or at uni or just in the street mixing with everyone, people also see their parents and the rest of the family in our children. So that if they see that, for example, our children are hugely ostentatious and driving the most expensive car, they might think, well, what do their parents teach them? But yeah, this is another thing we should just remember when we're raising our children, that inshallah we can also instill this idea of humility and also modesty, inshallah. So inshallah you've gained some extra reminders or thoughts from today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight.
Even as independent evidence of Israeli regime crimes continues to mount, Western nations are content to consume anti-Palestinian propaganda. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, earlier this month, a special United Nations commission issued a report documenting Israel's systematic use of sexual, reproductive, and gender-based violence in the occupied Palestinian territories since October 7, 2023. This comes as the Zionist regime has renewed its all-out war on Gaza after a few weeks of calm, the first phase of a now-discarded ceasefire agreement. The deal was meant to permanently end the violence, complete the exchange of Israeli and Palestinian captives, and oversee the Zionist regime's withdrawal from Gaza. It has now been derailed. Crimes involving sexual violence have been just one part of Israel's genocide in Gaza which has killed tens of thousands of people and decimated more than 80% of the territory's buildings. A few days before the UN report came out, we watched the American documentary October 8, which cited the baseless allegations that the resistance movement Hamas committed sexual violence during its 2023 Al-Aqsa Storm operation. The film, which focuses primarily on anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses in the ensuing months, is undisguised propaganda. It endorses the Zionist regime's goal of exterminating Hamas, including through combat tactics that are widely seen as genocidal, targeting Gaza's entire civilian population. Yet, there is no equivalence in the scope of the allegations of sexual violence by the two warring sides, nor in their documentation. October 8 references the events of a single day, while the United Nations Commission covers the entire period since then. The first relies on largely unsubstantiated Israeli accusations, while the second stems from a diligent and objective evidence-gathering process that was largely ignored in the West. Indeed, access to information about Israeli criminality is filtered in the West by systematic self-censorship, undoubtedly induced, at least indirectly, by the broadly pro-Israel allegiances of Western governments. While October 8 was shown in 100 theaters across the U.S., despite being undisguised state propaganda, the more artistically motivated and dramatically enacted No Other Land was denied distribution in the country, even though it won an Oscar, the industry's highest acclaim. The bias extends to the television and print platforms, which is why the Western media took little notice of the UN's reliably documented account of the systematic sexual abuse of Palestinian detainees, while according to prominence, to unverified accounts of the mistreatment of Israeli hostages. These double standards in public discourse are often fueled by Western political leaders who parrot Israeli state propaganda and enforce strict curbs on pro-Palestinian expression and protest. This biased atmosphere helps us to understand why there is such a knowledge and awareness gap when it comes to Israeli regime criminality. Under international law, the Zionist regime is an occupying power, and as such, it is obliged by the Fourth Geneva Convention to protect the civilian population under its control. The convention stipulates that civilians shall in all circumstances be treated humanely without any adverse distinction founded on race, color, religion or faith, sex, birth or wealth, or any similar criteria. It specifically prohibits sexual violence and mass forcible transfers of an occupied population. The Zionist regime's mistreatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories stands in flagrant disregard of these intentional legal obligations. In Gaza, the Zionist regime's principal goal is to terrorize Palestinians, pushing them to leave their homes or face near certain death. The Zionist regime's motives are no longer couched in the language of security, but are now openly territorial. From the outset of its occupation of Gaza and the West Bank in 1967, the Israeli regime has defied international humanitarian law in numerous ways. This was amply documented in a near-unanimous advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice in July 2024, which addressed only the pre-October 7 violations. Significantly, the ICJ concluded that Israel has so fundamentally violated the Geneva Conventions that its occupation is thus unlawful, putting the UN and member states under an obligation to act accordingly. As the Zionist regime's genocidal assault on Gaza has continued month after month, the United Nations has noted a deliberate effort by the state to target Palestinian civilians. This has been exhibited through Israel's frequent bombing of residential structures and neighborhoods, and its reliance on high-yield explosives, making it difficult for civilians to seek refuge. These combat patterns have led to a disproportionate number of women and children dying. On the ground, Israeli regime forces are given carte blanche to carry out sadistic abuses of men and women, including prolonged and abusive strip searching, coercive interrogation, torture, and a variety of humiliating and harassing practices that enjoy tacit government approval. The Zionist regime's toleration of sexual violence against Palestinians, as described in this month's UN report, has been shocking, with top officials either dismissing such allegations as anti-Semitism or suggesting the abuse was justifiable retribution for the October 7th Al-Aqsa Storm operation. The UN report notes the statements and actions by political and civic leaders and the lack of effectiveness of the military judicial system send a clear message to Israeli forces that they can continue committing such acts without fear of accountability. This report makes a convincing case that sexual violence has been not only tolerated but encouraged by top Israeli regime officials. This dehumanization of the Palestinian people is closely linked with Israel's overt plan to forcibly transfer Gaza's civilian population, not for reasons of security, but to fulfill the Zionist mission of clearing the way for the establishment of Greater Israel as a Jewish supremacist state. Black Box.
Part 1.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the name of God, on the night of February 25th to 26th, 2025, Israeli fighter jets carried out airstrikes in the city of Al-Qiswa, located south of Damascus, the capital of Syria. Shortly after, Al Jazeera released a statement saying, the Israeli bombardment in the Al-Qiswa region of rural Damascus targeted military positions belonging to the former Syrian army. Following this line of reporting, the Saudi channel Al Hadath released a report alleging, in a separate incident, that the Israeli army had raided sites used by Iranian militias, quote-unquote, located between the provinces of Quneitra and Dar'a in southern Syria. Qatari channel Al Jazeera and Saudi channel Al Hadath chose to mislead their viewers regarding the Israeli attacks in Syrian territory, attempting to claim that these strikes are not aimed at Syria, its people, its capabilities, or its sovereignty. Instead, they portray these actions as mere bombings targeting military facilities of a long-gone army or against militias that no longer exist in Syria. As a result, Al Jazeera and Al Hadath are trying to convince us that these bombings and attacks are insignificant and have no military or political repercussions, suggesting that we can simply overlook them as if they don't exist. On the same night of the bombing, which also saw an Israeli ground incursion into various areas of southern Syria, some media outlets supportive of the new Syrian regime claim that there is only one occupation in Syria, which they assert has ended, the occupation of power by Bashar al-Assad.
Once again, this suggests that there is no Israeli occupation of Syrian territories, nor is there an American occupation, even though the enemy took control of these areas just weeks ago, not 50 years ago. They have recently occupied strategically significant Syrian lands covering hundreds of square kilometers. In other words, this stance implies that the extent of the enemy's occupation of Syrian territories and the ongoing attacks against Syria are secondary issues that can be overlooked, allowing life to continue as if nothing has happened. This is in fact referred to as normalization with the occupation, and it has no other name. The perspectives of Al Jazeera and Al Hadath on one hand, and those of certain journalists who support the new Syrian regime on the other, closely resemble the views of Syria's new leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani. He has consistently stated in various interviews that the rationale for Israeli attacks in Syria has been nullified due to the regime's collapse and the withdrawal of Iran and Hezbollah from the country. Al-Jolani's statements, which we will discuss further in the episode, appear to reflect a stance of neutrality regarding the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights, which has been in place since 1967. Additionally, they seem to express a neutral position on the recent Israeli occupation of Syrian territory, along with the enemy's intention to create what they refer to as a buffer zone encompassing the entire southern region of Syria. Our episode today doesn't focus on Al Jazeera, Al Hadath, or some media outlets that seek to downplay the gravity of the occupation. Our episode today focuses on the Israeli invasion of Syria and its true objectives, as reported by the United States. However, our country's mainstream media has chosen to ignore it and dismiss it as insignificant. On December 8, 2024, as Damascus fell to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, formerly known as the al-Nusra Front, the Israeli occupation army declared the launch of Operation Bashan Arrow. This marked the largest ground invasion of an Arab country outside the occupied territories of Palestine since 1982. The announcement was paired with the most extensive aerial operation in Syria's history, featuring possibly over 1,000 airstrikes targeting numerous regions across the country. The outcome of the Israeli invasion was an expansion of the occupied Syrian territory, which originally included the Golan Heights, seized in 1967, and now encompasses more than 30 villages, towns, and farms that are currently under the direct control of enemy forces. Areas such as Gunetra, Mount Hermon, and part of rural Dar'a are now under the control of the Israeli occupation army. According to multiple reports, the area occupied by Israel in Syria after December 8, 2024, not including the Golan Heights, reached more than 460 square kilometers. An area larger than that occupied by enemy forces in Gaza and Lebanon has been affected by over 16 months of fighting during the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. After bolstering its presence and positions in Syrian territory, the Israeli occupation army has become a key player in the evolving political landscape of Syria. In recent weeks, enemy leaders have set various boundaries for the new regime in Damascus and have started to exploit sectarian and ethnic tensions within Syria. With blatant audacity, the occupying entity, through its political and military officials, announced that it was obstructing the development of the new Syrian regime's army in southern Syria. Almost immediately, enemy leaders began to incite the residents of the Syrian province of Soweida to align with their sect members in the Golan Heights and occupied Palestine. The situation escalated to a point where the occupying leaders threatened to intervene in Jaramana, which lies within the administrative borders of the Syrian capital Damascus, using the old Israeli justification of protecting minorities. This grim scenario in the new Syria presents two tragic dimensions, making it challenging to determine which is more sorrowful than the other. The first dimension involves the significant losses we all endure due to the enemy's actions on the ground, which they never anticipated, reaching a level that various observers have described as Israel's current transformation of the Syrian landscape. As for the second dimension of the tragedy, perhaps more intricate than the first, is the contempt, indifference, and near lethargy that accompany this momentous event. The only thing missing to underline the defeat is the sight of Israeli tanks rolling into the center of the Syrian capital, Damascus, God forbid.
وسط العاصمة السورية دمشق لا سمح الله. مركزية سوريا بالنسبة للعدو الإسرائيلي بتتخطى الجغرافيا.
The significance of Syria to the Israeli enemy extends beyond mere geography. It encompasses both political and moral dimensions. Geographically, Syria represents one half of the nation, with Egypt being the other half. Throughout history, Syria, also known as the Levant, has served as a gateway to the conquest and liberation of the region. The historical link between Egypt and Syria has been crucial for the nation's revival. Consequently, it became essential to create a colonial entity that would act as a demographic and geographical barrier hindering communication between Egypt and Syria, as well as between the western and eastern parts of the nation. Regionally, Syria, along with Egypt and Iraq, was a significant demographic and political force among Arabs, playing the key role in the pursuit of an independent Arab project. However, following the diminished influence of Egypt due to the Camp David Accords in 1978 and 1979, Iraq was destroyed and then occupied in 2003. Syria remained the sole foundation upon which a genuine Arab initiative could be built to challenge American dominance and Zionist arrogance in the region. This is why Syria has consistently been a source of concern for Israel. Not only did it refuse to surrender to the enemy and accept the occupation of its lands, its occupation of all our territories, not just its own, but it also represented a popular political experience that bolstered the resilience and growth of resistance forces in the region, especially after 1982, the year when Beirut, the Lebanese capital, was occupied and destroyed. In response, Syria was able to strengthen its economy and military capabilities to the extent that it maintained a balance of power through fear with its Israeli enemy for many years. Up until 2011, Syria was a significant regional player on the U.S. sanctions list, and even more importantly, a major contender among the powers deemed a threat to Israel, according to the enemy's own research institutions. Ideologically, Syria represents the older brother to those resisting Israel. This role has persisted for decades owing to its geographical and strategic proximity to Lebanon and Palestine, as well as the deep-rooted cultural and social identity of the Levant, or Greater Syria. This identity continues to be evident despite colonial divisions, and has played a crucial role in Syria's regional influence, a role that can only be sustained or developed at the expense of Israel. As a result, there was a mutual understanding between the Israeli enemy and the Syrian state and people that the region could not accommodate the simultaneous presence and rise of both parties. Therefore, Syria has consistently been on Israel's agenda, whether through direct occupation, destruction, or division. The losses experienced by Syria and its entire population due to this invasion are beyond what we can fully document. Undoubtedly, the human toll of martyrs and the injured is most profound and significant. However, beyond the human cost, we can identify three additional types of losses in the areas of Syria occupied by Israel. One, loss of territory. Two, loss of resources. And three, perhaps the most critical, the loss of consciousness. The loss of land is the most apparent and significant issue at hand. Based on our extensive experience with the Zionists, we understand that land loss is not a temporary setback or merely a gradual shift that ends with the conclusion of military operations. The clear intentions and the ongoing plans of the Zionist agenda reveal that the occupation of any Arab territory by enemy forces aims to subject this land to what they falsely call Israeli sovereignty. This is evident in the cases of Palestine and the occupied Syrian Golan, where Israeli military presence has extended beyond mere military actions to include colonization efforts and, to a lesser extent, social and geographical changes in the occupied land. These actions are designed to subjugate the existing societies and benefit the enemy's economy. Therefore, any Zionist occupation of Arab territory, whether through military force or colonization, as seen in the West Bank, represents a new battle and consequently an additional challenge in our struggle to reclaim the land and restore our freedom. In addition to colonization, the adversary is actively working through its invasions to create a buffer zone that stretches from the administrative borders of the Syrian capital, Damascus, to the mountains along the Syrian-Lebanese border in the west, and down to the Syrian-Jordanian borders in the south. Currently, there are efforts to expand this zone further eastward to reach the Syrian-Iraqi borders. This area will not only protect Israel from any resistance activities or the potential for future resistance between Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, but it will also reinforce the fragmentation of what remains of Syrian territorial unity, which is already divided among Turkish, American, and expanding Israeli occupations, both direct and indirect. Moreover, the Israeli occupation will strengthen its direct siege on resistance efforts in Lebanon, disrupting supply lines and posing a threat to the Lebanese resistance, particularly in the Baqa region in eastern and northeastern Lebanon. The presence of the occupying army on the highest peak of Mount Hermon puts the entire Baqa region within the sight and range of Israeli fire. As a result, the Israeli army no longer relies on the Air Force, as they are positioned at the top of the mountain with the Baqa Valley under their intelligence control. An Israeli soldier can survey the entire plain from south to north using binoculars and cameras. The significant loss of land in Syria is highlighted by the occupation of Mount Hermon, along with the desecration of its summit by Netanyahu and his soldiers. In addition to what's been mentioned about Mount Hermon, for those who may not know, this mountain not only overlooks Syria and the Baqa Valley in Lebanon, but also extends its view over Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. The summit of this mountain was taken by the occupying army in 1967 and was regarded as one of the challenging positions to reclaim due to its elevation. However, this hard-to-liberate land was regained by the heroes of the Syrian Arab Army during the battle in October 1973. The battles of Mount Hermon, which lasted over 10 days, became historic scenes showcasing the heroism and bravery of the Arab soldier, particularly the Syrian Arab soldier who managed to achieve the impossible and return the summit of Mount Hermon to Syria. Since that moment, this peak has stood as an impregnable fortress against enemy plans, remaining secure until December 8, 2024, when a new Zionist invasion of Syria occurred. Mount Hermon symbolizes the additional challenges, not just geographical, that we as a people must overcome and confront. We will pay a steep price and make significant sacrifices to regain what we lost during the Zionist invasion of Syria and in our quest for the liberation of all Arab lands. This octopus-like expansion of the Israeli enemy will give it greater military superiority and an enhanced ability to shape the political landscape, as well as to promote partition plans and civil conflicts in three pivotal countries in the region: Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. At the end of the episode, we will explore a highly significant and risky political objective that the Israeli entity aims to achieve through its control over Syrian territory. The second type of loss following the Israeli invasion of Syria is the destruction of Syrian military capabilities. In fact, Israel's campaign against Syrian military strength did not begin on December 8, 2024. It actually dates back to the onset of the Syrian war in 2011. Since then, Israeli forces have targeted various Syrian military positions, particularly focusing on scientific research centers and air defense systems. During the same period, groups that would later be known as the Syrian Armed Opposition volunteered to dismantle Syrian air defense systems, despite having no role in the conflict other than confronting Israeli warplanes. It's also worth noting that just days before the fall of Damascus, the Syrian Arab Army was the only Arab military capable of challenging Israeli air power. Following significant losses to Syrian air defense systems, the Syrian army continued to resist, with air defense personnel becoming martyrs as they faced off against Israeli jets and missiles, despite the vast disparity in capabilities and the impact of the siege. It's worth noting that on February 10, 2018, the air defenses of the Syrian Arab Army successfully shot down an Israeli F-16 before it could enter Syrian airspace. However, the events that unfolded between December 8th and 12th, 2024, were quite different. According to enemy reports and local assessments, over 90% of Syria's military capabilities were destroyed in just 4 days. This capability includes aircraft, remaining air defense systems, a vast